No. Be afraid. Be very afraid.
There's nothing to fear except God. Whatever that means to you.
Do I look like someone who cares what God thinks?
You're listening to a podcast exploring faith and fear, what scares us and what saves us. This is The Fear of God.
Hello and welcome back to The Fear of God podcast. Listen, listener. You can find all your favorite foggy paraphernalia at thefearofgodpodcast.com. What is the fear of God? Well, every week here at the Fear of God, we explore what scares us in order to find what saves us. And by we, I mean me, one of your hosts, Nathan Rouse.
And me, your other co-host, Reed Lackey.
Reed, welcome.
Nathan, how you doing, man? Really? Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Speaking of Usher, last week, you know. We are. All right, Reed. Oh. Today's conversation.
Listen, we've been invaded.
We have. By a booty snatcher. Today's conversation is a bit of a coda on our foray into the horror films of the previous year. Because we did a run of 2023 films, and then, so you thought, listener, we wrapped it all up last week with the fall of the House of Usher. Yeah. But we wanted to squeeze one more in because we just can't handle fully embracing 2024 yet. Right. So who can save us from moving into 2024 and all the craziness that's going to be present and happen? Who will save us? If this film has anything to say about it, no one. Reed.
Wow.
No one. Okay. I just read the title and watch the movie. And following that bleak intro for today's film,
wow,
permit me to welcome onto the show the man who's always ready with an anal probe, Quarterly King, and our personal friend, Ian Olsen. Ian, well, hey, buddy.
Let me just say, you know, I haven't seen your faces in a long time. It's been... It's good to see this end.
Not what I meant when I said get behind me.
All right. So, oh my gosh, we're about to lose Ian. We got him. Okay, listeners, we're going to take a very brief moment to head to the Patreon-mobile where we're just going to catch up for a second. So if you want to listen to us catch up with Ian, talk a little stuff, join Patreon.
Thanks.
We'll be back in a minute. Yeah. So, about this movie. So, Reed, if it's all right, I'm gonna take this one here for a second.
Okay. Should have done this as a part of our Silent Era series.
Right, exactly. okay. IMDb summarizes No One Will Save You as an exiled, anxiety-ridden homebody. That's just layer upon layer, IMDb. Man.
True.
Must
much.
Battle, right. Must battle an alien who's found its way into her home. Now,
That's it.
I wanted to lead off here because I want to punt to Ian here because we, you know, we often spend this moment chatting about, you know, our experience of the film and that sort of thing. And I, along with the viewing for this conversation, have seen this film twice now. And after I saw it the first time, I was like, I wonder what Ian thinks of this, because constant listeners may know. Six years ago, something like that. The first time Sir Olsen was on The Fear of God was to
discuss. Dang, that was 7 years ago.
Yes, it was.
Isn't it crazy?
Chapter one. And yeah. I'd never met you in person. I had not talked to you before. And then we get on this conversation and we're asking questions like, what scares you? And you start going off about greens and grays. And I'm like, holy shit, what is going on here? This is the real deal.
What have I done?
Right? Yeah, I made a terrible mistake.
And now listen, I am an X-Files fan to the bone, even during the bad times. So when you start talking about it, I knew what you were referring to, but I'd never heard it so personalized. And so watching this movie, I was like, legitimately, I'm being jokey and heightened because that's what I do. And it's, you know, podcast time. But I watched this movie and I really was like, I wonder what Ian thinks of this. And so I'm going to pivot to you of like, when you first saw this movie or when you first received that text, what's your thought? What'd you think after you watched it? You know, what are your thoughts on No One Will Save You, the film, Ian?
My grander thoughts will, you know, sure.
Yeah.
Be unveiled. I was intrigued because it's right there. Like, that's what you know, there were a couple people who said, so this movie's for you.
You know, given- I really wanted to be the only one, but that's how I think, but whatever.
No, that is such a definitive thing for me that more than one person said, so someone tapped into your psyche and they made this movie and you are obligated to watch it and report back.
The exiled homebody.
It wasn't even about the alien. It was just
yeah, exactly. You started going off during the patron segment about reading comic books, and I was like, oh, he is definitely like her.
Nerd.
Anyway, so yes,
stayed at home, people making miniatures. So I saw that it had good reviews. I saw that it was pretty brief, so I thought, okay,
yep,
you know, I'll invest. And I checked it out, and while I like it, I gotta say, you've already mentioned the X-Files, Nathan, and like, this film did not touch the raw, like the nerve of raw terror that I think it's an episode in season one where like the beginning of the episode is the guy kind of like, he's starting to like come awake in bed, and then he looks around and there's gray surrounding the bed, and then he's just screaming, and then it goes to opening credits.
Well, this would likely be circa season 3-ish with Pusher, Robert Madel, who Robert Madel is Pusher, but what you're thinking of is the guy who eventually abducts Scully because he's been taken.
Anyway, oh, is that where that goes?
Yeah. So it wouldn't be season one yet because in the meta narrative of X-Files lore, Scully had to get off the show because Gillian Anderson was pregnant. And they're like, how do we get you off the show for a little run? And they had her get taken by this guy who had been abducted multiple times over. While you're talking, his name's probably going to come to me because Dwayne Barry. Holy cow. Look at that.
That's yes. Yes. I remember this. Wow.
Yes. Wow. I can't do much in the world, but I can conjure.
Lisa Nagai. Lisa Nagai.
Yes, that's me.
Imadi.
Dwayne Barry. Yes, Dwayne Barry. Yep, that's
there,
it.
There was an episode guide like to the first three seasons. So like I remember that name was just like indelibly imprinted in my memory.
Yep.
And then I managed to heal a bit and forget it, and now here it is, you know, just tormenting me all over again. So I really like how this movie, for the most part, tries to stick with the sheer horror of a close encounter of the, well, attempted. Yeah. I mean, ultimately a close encounter of the fourth kind. But I gotta stick by it. It doesn't quite tap into that terror that so racked me for three years of my life where I scarcely slept. And I don't think that is a failure for not having done so. It just doesn't quite have the same kind of the X-Files successfully, I think, tapped almost like a cosmic horror with its grays. And No One Will Save You almost reminds me a little bit of, my goodness, what's the Katharine Hepburn movie where she's blind?
The Audrey Hepburn movie with
Audrey Hepburn, not Catherine.
It's not Don't Look Now. That's the Donald Sutherland flick. Wait Until Dark. Is the mention.
Directed by Dwayne Barry, yes.
directed by Dwayne Barry. This is the game of this episode, is like, right. Let's make an obscure reference and see who can conjure it first.
That would be Dwayne Barry's autobiography. So bad. That would be his memoir. Like, so how you been? Like, hey man, Wait Till Dark. So that's what I would say. This movie felt almost more like Wait Until Dark than X-Files at its best.
Cool. Heard. Reed, what about you? I don't know that we've actively talked about it.
Discussed it? There's a profound affectionate association with this movie because it's not every year, but has become a little bit of a recurring tradition that around early October, when my birthday hits, my family like to go up to Big Bear Mountain and rent a cabin and just enjoy a few days up in some crisp mountain air and just, you know, kind of get away from it all.
That's absolutely.
It was beautiful. Well, this past year, proximal to our getting there, this film had just released and I hadn't seen it yet. So my wife and I were looking for ways to, you know, kill a mountain afternoon before we were out and about to do our stuff. And so we watched this film just, you know, in a cabin. It wasn't so remote as this place, but as the place in the film, but, you know, kind of out of the way and surrounded by trees and lovely open windows and a fireplace. And it was just great. So the aesthetic appeal already engendered a lot of affection towards this film. Now, the first time I saw it, I watched it and with only one small little note, which I will bring up at some point in this conversation, loved everything about it. Again, with one small little caveat that I will mention at some point. And then I really hiccuped at the end where I was like, ah, wait, what? I didn't, mm-hmm. Not quite sure what's going on. What's the deal? What's the thing? What are we doing? And so that was my first experience of the film. You know, kind of loved it up until the end where it kind of lost me a little bit. I didn't quite get it. I was eager to revisit it because of how much I had enjoyed the first part of it. And, you know, perhaps spoiler alert for the conversation that we're about to have, I love it, including the ending. I think I grasp more now what the ending was kind of after. And while I still think it makes some choices that, you know, don't totally land cleanly, I really admire this film. I think it's incredibly fun. There's this new wave happening occasionally in horror, an upcoming release called it's out in theaters right now, and especially by the time this episode lands, called Late Night with the Devil, is in a similar fashion to this, where it's a feature film, all the trimmings, all the bells and whistles of a feature film, but has a kind of a flavor of a lengthy Twilight Zone episode or the flavor of a lengthy episode of, you know, it's just a little bit more downbeat in terms of its intimacy, in terms of its focus and its scope. And I like that we're starting to get more films like that. I love that flavor. I really enjoy people kind of taking an opportunity to experiment with form and to experiment with some gimmicks. This film has a gimmick to it. And so I just enjoy that filmmakers are kind of flexing their muscles in that way. So yeah, I won't love everything about this film, but overwhelmingly have a lot of affection for it. That's me with this, with No One Will Save You.
Hmm.
How about you, Nathan Rouse?
So, okay. Well, here's the good news is that being amongst friends who can talk us through our feelings here. So the first time I watched this, love might have been a strong word, but had a grand old time with it. Mm. Like, there's so much to like about it and or things to love. You know, the performance, the cinematography, just the design of the aliens, the weirdness the longer it goes, the design of some of the set pieces. So it really had nothing but praise the first time. And was it circumstantial? Is it the film itself? Is it me? I just don't know. This time around felt very tedious. I just couldn't get back on its wavelength. And that's why I'm kind of two minds here, because I'm not even saying it's the film. I am saying it's possibly me, but it might also be a little bit the film, because nothing. Yeah. I struggled a lot more this time. And I think I felt the absence of, I felt the gimmick more, than I did the first time. The first time I was like, oh, wow, look. Oh, okay. This time I was like, okay. Yeah. Yeah. That doesn't make a ton of sense why you might not say something here.
You know, it's interesting that you say that. Do you mind if we probe that a little bit? Alien reference. So
hold on.
Ian's like, that's my job. All seriousness, I felt it more. I just want to unpack it a little bit with you, because I felt it more the first time, I think, because it stood out to me times where it felt like somebody should have said something. And this time around, knowing that they wouldn't helped me forgive it. Sure. I'm just wondering, like, did it make no difference the fact that you're like, well, yeah, I know nobody talks in this movie, so can kind of dismiss it, or was it? I guess I'm asking, why was it more front of mind? That is the gimmick for listeners who haven't seen this film and don't know. Like, there's five words of dialogue in the entire 90-minute movie. But why did that stand out to you more this time, do you think?
Well, here's what's fascinating is the first go round, I didn't know the gimmick before I started it. And so there was a sense of discovering the gimmick, which, you know, gimmick is a disparaging word. I don't mean it meanly. I just mean, like, not knowing going into it. All you know is buzzy, you know, kind of movie, alien movie. Okay, cool. Let's check this out. You know, to Ian's point, brisk, sweet, always a win. And so starting it and not really noticing the gimmick until you start realizing, oh, okay, I think this is what you're doing. And sure enough, that being what they're doing. And so I think just with this go around, there wasn't that discovering aspect of it. And so I don't know. And again, I'm not actually trying to even level criticism at the film itself necessarily. I am just saying my experience of watching it the second time surprised me how deflated I felt actually watching it. And so I don't really have a ton to explain that beyond just, you know, the curiosity perhaps factor of, well, knowing I'm coming to you, Ian, here's why I still didn't want to register that information yet to the two of you. Wasn't to gotcha, but because I am intrigued to talk about it, because I do think, like, the ending being what it is, the title being what it is, like, these are significant markers and significant choices that merit the conversation. So that's why I was like, well, you know, I'm the way we always do. You know, we're going to have a rich conversation, and I'm banking on that aspect. But my energy watching it this time was pretty deflated compared to where it was the first time. Yeah, Ian.
Well, first, I want to say that this is already really interesting, because I'm somewhere between the both of you, where as of now, I don't have as deflated and down a view of it, but I also I don't have as elevated a view as you, Reed. So I wanted to register that first, which means that I am the most even keeled and best interpreter for this movie. Yeah, right. I mean, how fortunate that it was me. But the second thing I want to say is that I think that the word gimmick is apt in this case. The reason that I think that is that when a choice about it, okay, so for instance, for several years I have thought it'd be fascinating to make a horror movie that primarily relies on diegetic sound. Okay. Sure. So what's happening in the film itself, but also on music. And I still think that should be done. I think that the idea of what if there was not overt exposition? What if there were not multiple characters? So what if we were focused on the living, the action of one person in isolation? A natural consequence of that will be little dialogue. I just think that there is a point, and I don't think that it's possible to stipulate what that threshold is, where, you know, after 48 minutes, you know, like now you're really stretching it. But I think there is a point where it's like, okay, you're not going to talk. Okay, I get it. I think that it is a distinction that I want to make just in general. I think that it's subjectively apprehended, but I don't think that it's subjective in the sense that most people use that word, where it's purely arbitrary, where it's purely, well, you see it that way and I don't. I just mean that I think that it, when it is subjectively apprehended, it takes a subject and one who is, you know, has their taste tested over time and it grows to see, like, you're, why didn't anyone talk right there? You're telling me, you're, no one spoke, really, movie. I the first time I was much more forgiving. Yeah. And I would say, in large part, I think retroactively, because I did not know that was the movie's thing. The movie's thing at that point in time for me was alien abduction, happening in more or less real time.
Yeah.
So then kind of like seeing, I was interested to see, like, okay, we're not relying on the movie's going to show us things instead of telling us things. But then it literally did not tell us things. And it does strike me as having crossed that line that cannot just be, you know, drawn with a gauge. There's no compass that says gimmick. But I think that it does fall just on that line. And I'm not trying to be overly harsh with it.
Yeah.
But I think that happened.
That's one of the, I mentioned in my assessment of it, the one little caveat that I would give to my love is I don't like that nobody talks. I don't mind that we don't hear any dialogue. Like, just not to put too fine a point on it, there's a scene in the film where she, our main character, named Bren, played by Caitlin Dever, she confronts or comes into contact with two people whose lives she has devastated. And the scene awkwardly plays out that nobody says anything to each other. What I would have loved is if in that moment you cut away, you're inside a police station, you cut away to an office through a latticed sort of window of a shut door, and you see, with no audible dialogue,
yeah, like
them
that.
Yelling at her, or, you know, them going or off at some degree.
Station, yeah.
Or outside the station. And then you cut back to the moment where the mom spits in her face, and then you don't actually hear anything. It keeps the form. There's no spoken dialogue.
Better choice, Lackey. I like it.
But and there's a couple of options that they could have done that. Thank you, Nathan. There's a couple of options that they could have done that. In the bus scene is the other scene where I'm like, why is nobody yelling? Why is nobody screaming? And I think you could have accomplished the same thing. How many films does everything in a tense, suspenseful moment slow down and you see people's mouths moving, but you don't hear what's happening? If the film had made that choice, I think I would have been completely defensive of the gimmick and completely like, no, I love the choices they made here. But instead, they went for, we're just not going to have anybody say anything. And that feels forced.
I could not agree more. Those are markers that, for me, like a gimmick is when, damn the consequences, nobody's talking. And instead of like, no, we are having, like, silence is an important feature in the texture of this film that does work. And the choices that you're making, the choices that you're describing, they are in subservience to that that concept, and form matches the material. Then, instead of wrenching, again, it's just kind of like damn the torpedoes, full speed ahead.
Right.
We're doing this semi-naturalistically.
Yes.
But no one's talking and it doesn't
make sense. To the point that when the cop dad goes to, like, he's going to say something, it reads as actor stopping himself.
Yeah.
Yes.
I agree with that. As
character catching himself.
Yeah. And I agree with that.
And to both y'all's point, because I was thinking about this, because I did attempt to watch this with Penny. She, here's a funny little note about the movie and watching it with your growing horror appreciator of a middle child. The movie opens with Bren waking up in bed. You know, it's like the day's beginning. Literally, Penny says, it'd be unfortunate if I slept through an alien invasion. And I said, well, if anyone could do it, you could. And y'all, within 20 minutes, she was asleep. Like, of course you are. Of course you are. But I told her up front, I was like, hey, you know, just FYI, you know, there's, maybe I shouldn't have done this, but there's no dialogue in the movie. And she's like, oh, like Quiet Place. And I said, well, no, actually, Quiet Place's choice actually serves that story.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Like there, a world got created in text that justifies this meta text choice.
Exactly. Whereas
here, you can make a case, and I'm open to hearing it, that thematically this choice serves it, but it doesn't, but it kind of breaks the reality you're trying to present to me. And that's where it becomes challenging.
No, I'm sorry to have cut you off. I feel like they just got too cutesy with those couple of scenes. When she's alone, when she's alone with the alien, I have no problem with her not saying anything. I feel like they just got too cutesy with those couple of scenes that we're mentioning. And in a film that has a lot of competencies otherwise, it just doesn't. Yeah, those scenes don't totally work for me. Even I love the film, but those I would say could have made a different choice there that would have kept your creative choice intact without taking your audience out of the film. Is my film. Yeah.
Yeah. It's proof that what you are trying to accomplish as writer, director, you still face limitations. Mm-hmm. And if you blunder through them, what you are making suffers, that you are not a God who can make whatever you envision and it is what it should be. Mm-hmm. You have to accept, you know, the implausibility of certain things. You have to accept, well, this would be a consequence of that. Yeah. And if you ignore that, your work suffers.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's funny, you know, that I do, even though my feelings post second viewing are tepid, I do like overall the conversation yielded by just kind of on a, you know, cinematic level, what sound does. And you know, Reed, we talked about on Bo is Afraid, like so much of Ari Aster's choice making is so considered, so intentional, so fine-tooth combed on almost every level. And then you watch something like this, which a lot is considered, like the world is considered, the design is considered, but to the broader point that keeps being made, and you know, I risk, you know, kind of just hammering it home here, is you chose a choice that is fun, and you found a way to maybe thematically make it rich, but doesn't consider the ways it sort of hampers or hinders or harms other aspects of it. Anyway, I'll shut up because it feels like I'm just beating that one up. But
no, I mean, and I think we definitely can move on from this, but I do think it was worth the time because it's a big choice of the film. It's not a minute secondary corner of the basement of this film. It is front and center. That is a creative choice that they made. So I think it deserved a little bit of time. But
for sure.
One of the other things that I found interesting in my viewing that I was very affectionate towards is the choices at the end. So one of the things that I really zoned in on this time around, knowing where the film was going, I was able to pay a little bit more attention to the fact that she, despite what she has done, And listeners, this is a spoiler show, so we're going to be very, very quickly getting into major spoilers for this film. We don't often give a spoiler warning, but I do think some of the turns and surprises here perhaps merit it. She has made some choices in her life, has done some things that have ostracized her from the entire community. And she tries in her way to make herself presentable, to make herself very pretty, to be friendly and to be approachable. She makes herself all of those things and then tries in her way to reach out and be friendly with neighbors, and is just utterly a pariah to everyone around her. And so I found it interesting because the first time around, I was too caught up at the end with, wait, is she also turned? Is she... you know, an alien that, or like, has she been infected by the thing? Have the aliens just, you know, kind of adopted her as it was? And to me, this viewing around it, the ending felt happier for one thing. But also it felt like she had finally reached that place where she felt seen, felt understood, where her interior life, again, this perhaps attaches itself to the choice in the film of silence, but her interior life, the unspoken things, were now understood by everyone around her, and she was able to just be more free. She was able to just be more open. She could look at the world around her with a certain degree of warmth and maybe more protection than it felt like was present to her before the aliens invaded. And I really responded to that. I responded a lot to the fact that the film is called No One Will Save You. And the easy analog to put on there is, well, when aliens invade and you've made yourself a pariah to the entire neighboring community, nobody will step in to help you. But this time around, I zoned in on the letter that she wrote to Maude, where she said, I'll never forgive myself. You know, and one of the things that obviously in either spiritual considerations or psychological considerations, we talk about our sins and our transgresses and the things that we have done wrong and our need to be saved. And what stood out to me about this viewing, in contrast to my first viewing was very much like, oh, the aliens are coming and ain't nobody gonna help her. That's what the film means, you know? This time around, something a bit more profound stood out to me in thinking about my own wrongdoings, the times that I wish so desperately I could take back, the times that I wish so desperately I could undo, and to have to sit in those and to think about, nobody will understand this. If I confess this, nobody will extend a hand of warmth. Nobody will extend a hand of forgiveness. Nobody will extend, you know, even... if you want to go there, even God himself would be like, that's too far. You're irredeemable. And that is what stood out to me about this viewing. And I think maybe to a degree, my affection rose because I responded to that. I responded to that tension of, she has done a potentially irredeemable thing, but she didn't mean to do it. She didn't do it maliciously. It was very of the moment. It was, you know, you can't take it back. She's just accidentally killed her dear friend. So she can't take that back, but nobody's going to rescue her from that. Nobody is going to see into that and tell her it's okay, or tell her, hey, you have a path forward to forgiving yourself. She writes in that letter, she says, I don't think I'll ever forgive myself. And that just, all of that just sort of percolated to me about this film. And I think that elevated it for me. I think that thematic consideration of recognizing that, like, oh, this is not about aliens and rescuing them from aliens. You know, first viewing in, ooky, spooky, suspense scenes, they're great. We can spend some time on those, and I would totally love to spend some time on those. But that concept really resonated with me. I don't know. That's I think that's why I loved it more this time around, is because that connected with me. But I don't know if that pinged for either of you.
Well, let me take the opportunity of Ian being silent to jump in there and
wow no, he never shuts up, here we go.
Jump in while you can. That's what most guests say about me, so that, and you know, I think, Reed, that it's like I want to come to your side there.
Mm-hmm.
I struggle still to reconcile that. Now, let me restate what I think I'm hearing, which is, you know, this person who is isolated, who's, you know, kind of this one terrible act has, you know, kind of banished her from, you know, community and relationship, by film's end is able to experience arguably joy again, warmth again, but which is a lovely sort of arc and trajectory that I'm not 100% positive is true to the text. I'm not actually arguing it isn't, but because sure, Bryn by film's end is in a different emotional place than she is at film's beginning, but the facilitators of that arc are the ones who just overtook and arguably enslaved her community,
right,
and left her, you know, kind of decided to not do so to her, and so that's where I kind of struggle with feeling like her joy is true.
Well, I don't. That's not what I'm positing. To be real open with what you're saying, that I'm not evaluating the ethical merits of what she's experiencing. I'm simply observed that she was not isolated through this film. She was condemned. The reason she is on her own is because she is condemned by this community.
Sure.
By the end of the film, she is received. Now, there are real, to your point, there are real question marks to hang over, well, look at who received her. Okay, that's fair. I don't think that's this film. This film presents Bryn as condemned and then received. And my case in point is that we're not even 5 minutes into the movie. She waves at a neighbor who looks at her with utter disgust, turns around, walks away. She sort of shrugs, okay, you know, doesn't say anything, but shrugs and drives away. And after it's all said and done, there is a very deliberate moment where, before the dancing, where she walks down from the porch, waves at everybody, and a host of neighbors wave back to her. And so the point I feel you're making is her joy real and true? I don't think it matters. She has been received. Somebody saw into her, saw what she did, saw all of her ugliness, and chose to receive her. That's what happened to Bryn. And that's what I'm scratching at as what I feel is the emotional quotient of the film is, you know, there's definitely a real conversation to have about, like, well, yeah, but the aliens have enslaved humanity. Right. Yeah. That's I mean, like, yeah, sure. But look at the ending of Midsommar as a case in point. I would argue that as much horror as there is at the end of Midsommar, spoilers for Midsommar, that the central character, Florence Pugh's character, experiences more acceptance and community than she has ever experienced. And they just burned people alive, you know? And so I feel like to try to paint the aliens as either good guys or bad guys misses the point. I don't know that that's what you were trying to do. But I don't think the point is the aliens. I think the point is, what is Bryn experiencing from the community pre-alien, and what is she experiencing from the community after they've taken over everything? She's condemned, now she's received. Okay, I've made my point. But you know, you still don't have to agree, but I've made my point.
No, I'm thinking, that's all.
I feel like it's a contradiction that, you know, I'm just thinking about how, Reed, you said, like, that's not something like that's a question we can ask, but that's not what the movie's about, something like that.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I kind of think, like, no, the movie's not. Like, what I feel like is the movie didn't think about this.
And maybe it didn't. Yeah. Yeah.
Like, in the same way it didn't think about, like, does it make sense that no one says anything when she goes into town? Right, I feel like it's the same kind of contradiction where, like, all right, so now we're going to have this happen. And, you know, the question was not asked, well, is she received then? Like, when they all have the parasite slug controlling them, is she received? Because I guess that's what it's an ethical question. Yes, but it's like more than that. You know, I mean, it's like a question of, is she received? Like, the puppets do what they are marionetted to do. Mm-hmm. So yes, I mean, she enjoys it. I don't know if she will I don't know how long she will enjoy this reception when it is the same type of function as what happens on the bus when people are controlled by the alien parasite. It's just that it's beneficial to her now. And there's no doubt that after being condemned for long enough, that you will say, like, this, man, this is so much better. Mm-hmm. But I guess I also have to think that eventually, and that's not even assured, we can be in denial. We can delude ourselves for a lifetime.
Sure. Yeah.
I would hope that Bryn would say, I'm still not forgiven and received. My parasite ridden neighbors are doing what the aliens who were trying to do the same thing to me, mm-hmm. their strings are pulling them in this direction.
Yeah.
And this is part of the reason that I feel like the second half of the movie, it doesn't have the muscle to do. I think the first half is the best half of this movie. I think the second half then tries to expand into something, and I am not calling it a complete failure. I am just saying it does not succeed when it tries to change its mission profile. And then I will also add that while I think it does this thing better than many other attempts, I gotta say, I am tired of horror movies about trauma. I'm sick. I am sick to death of it. I'm sick of elevated horror where it's not really about the aliens, bro, or it's not about the ghosts, it's not about the demons, bro, it's about trauma. Like, well, you know what, then shut up, just make a movie about demons, just make one about monsters,
because
what you're doing sucks, so just do the scary thing.
And I would say, and I don't think, I mean, I understand what you mean, and I actually agree with you, but I think this film is not about trauma. I think if anything, for her, this is my contention for the film. My advocacy for the film is I think it is about a person desperate to be received. That's Bryn. That's where I think Bryn is I think she's desperate to be received. It is incidental, I think, that it happened because, like, she is waving at her neighbors. If this was a film about trauma, she would never leave her house. If this was a film about how the trauma affected her, she would never reach out. She would never leave her door. She's just closed off. And that's one way to tell this story. But she, from frame one,
I think that's what an especially bad example of this mm-hmm. hokey genre would do, because that does not describe all trauma responses. It's just that's what ChatGPT will produce for your script if you want to make another A24 movie about trauma that is
that's true. But I mean, and to your point, to your broad but very cogent point, there is going to be a certain degree of trauma in all conflict. I guess what I'm saying, with a full heart towards, you know, your perspective, is I don't think this film is about trauma. I think this time around, I really connected with Bryn feeling like nobody cared about her. Like, nobody. She's writing letters to Maude, you know? Mm-hmm. Like, this is a girl desperate to be heard, desperate to be received. She walks by the mourners at the graveside and waves at them, you know? Like, mm-hmm. she exhibits nothing to me in Caitlin Dever's performance that says her isolation is self-imposed. Nothing. She is isolated because she is ostracized. And I think that was the tipping point for me, is isolation, which is self-imposed. I would say that's more about a retreat into trauma. Now, to your point, there's a myriad of trauma responses. So I was a bit too generic in my assessment there. But I feel like this is a bit unconventional in that way, in that her isolation is not self-imposed. She's not out there in the country because she wants to be. The mailman delivers her a box and she perks up and sits up in the bench and looks, oh, do, and there's no dialogue, but you see in her face, do I have a visitor? Really? I have a visitor? Oh, it's just the mail guy throwing the box of dance footprints and record, you know, at the mailbox, doesn't even have the time to say hi to me. So it just really resonated with me about, like, this is somebody who's desperate to be seen. And so then when the aliens, you know, finally see, their response is not to squash her. Their response instead is to consort with each other, analyze, and then the all-seeing eye, whatever that eye up there is makes a decision, and she gets to live among them with at least someone who will treat her as one of them, even though she is not one of them. And there's ethical implications there. I'm not trying to ignore them. I'm just saying I responded to them. that's it.
We are on the same page for much of this. I feel like it kind of maybe steps on attack. So now it's kind of limping on one foot from the second half on. I feel like it would be stronger. And I know that we're not really big on how it should have ended. I'm not saying how it should have ended. There are paths that you can take. And then the beauty of retroactivity is that it seems so, like, organically continuous the entire way, when just like in life, this didn't have to go this way. It did, but now you can see the thread through it. I think it might've been stronger if the movie focused on, you know, the, be careful what you wish for, of, you want a visitor. Well, sis, you got it. And they're gonna probe you.
That's fair. Yeah. That's fair.
Because I, my complaints about trauma in so-called elevated horror being what they are, and I stand by them, I am still saying that this movie, your point is, you don't think it's really, like, quite doing that. And I'm saying, like, well, if it is, it still does it better than a lot of really hokey movies that try to be deep by playing around with pain. As if it's, you know, watercolors. I just think that it loses its way a bit, because it is playing to its strengths. It's not yet a gimmick when the focus is on the sounds that she's trying to control. Like, I mean, her performance is entirely physical that first half, when her house becomes this frightening arena that she only somewhat recognizes at night, you know, and it's kind of a resource to use, but it's also an impediment at the same time. I think that's hands down the best part of the movie. How to use my own space that I'm so familiar with under normal circumstances. I have to use this to my advantage. I should have home turf advantage. I don't entirely yet. I mustn't let any uncontrolled sound escape. Those are the points where, like, this movie is different, and I feel like is most consistent with what it sets up. And then, you know, when we get the second attempt at home invasion and abduction, it's in service to something more, and that can be fine. It's just not executed as well. That's my complaint. So it's not a major, like, man, it just massively fails from this point on. But I think that it is diminished because its promise doesn't come to fruition. That's what I would say.
Okay,
Reed, I'm curious. I am a hopeful SOB, and I want to, in the ways I comprehend, but feel a bit too. For in the moment, you know, join you in your celebration, or what I perceive of your desire to celebrate on Bryn's behalf. I guess this is part of what I bumped on the first time through, and feel like you are appropriately challenging, not as in actively, but as in just, you know, I'm trying to find my way past the yoga aliens towards you. Here is I guess I feel like, I'll say it this way, either the film is a little confused as I'm perceiving it, or I'm pretty confused, and maybe a little bit of both. Because I think there's something very, very powerful and intentionally heavy about the title, which even to me feels at odds with what it feels like you're, you know, kind of pointing to in terms of this received idea, because there's a world where this the what feels like the cutting room floor ending to the actual story is, you know, instead of big dance number, fade to black, credits with, you know, kind of 50s era music or whatever era exactly is represented here playing over it, that the next shot is Bryn, you know, kind of Clockwork Orange style, just sort of laid out in a alien ship somewhere, because really what we're just seeing is what they've fed to her. Mm-hmm. My point is simply, like, I'm struggling to figure out how to gel what I want to join you in and seeing with what feels like the trajectory of the literal story, coupled with what feels like the intention of a title like No One Will Save You. Is it, I'm not asking rhetorically, like, is it meant to be ironic? Is it meant to be cheeky? Because part of me, if we're following the story's through line directly, it's meant to be literal on a certain level.
Well, I think the more we've discussed it, and I am content, to be clear, so that we don't have a 2.5 hour episode about this, I am content to be the minority report. I will say that the more you, my dear, dear friends, have challenged the ideas in this film, the more my energy has risen towards it. I went into this thinking, oh, I found this interesting. The more that we've kind of tried to unpack it, the more I'm like, oh, dang, no, like, because this is here, and this is here, and this is here. Look at the song that she's playing. The song that she is playing, that she is dancing to, is a song from the 40s called Knock on Any Door. And I just pulled up the lyrics. It says, knock on any door, you'll find a welcome, rain or shine. So when you need consolation and some friendly conversation, simply knock on any door in my hometown. Now, again, I want to draw a distinction between, we don't have to feel like the ones she has been received by are inherently good. And we don't have to feel that those who have taken her in are inherently good and therefore need to justify what they have done. The Sure. film is about Bryn's experience. And if we're looking through the lens of the film, she has found a better place, because she has found, and Ian, you make a good point. Will it last forever? I don't know. But she lives under No One Will Save You. That's what she lives under. That's where we find it. And then it is worth noting that in the end, in the dancing scene, like when she first dances, here's how we first see her dancing, is because she has got a kit with some footprints she lays out in her home alone. Sure. And puts on the record and pretends that she's dancing. At the end, she's dancing with an entire group of people. Now, I'm not trying to ignore, are they alien infected puppets? To Bryn, does it matter? They're smiling at her. They're looking at her in the eye. They're receiving her. They're dancing with her. And then she looks at us. I don't think that's insignificant. She looks out at the camera at one point and looks out with this big, wide open grin. And it's like, you know, we see that regardless of our ethical feelings, and they're real, I'm not trying to dismiss them, regardless of our ethical feelings about what the aliens have done, she's happy. Like, God bless her, she's happy and dancing, you know?
But I see, yeah, I mean, she looks at us, but yes, I see that as the gaze. And the gaze is not as popularized now as like male gaze, but that idea was formulated by Jacques Lacan, and that is the idea that in a work, he mostly talked about paintings, but it definitely works in movies, because the gaze does not even have to be a subject in the film looking at you. Mm-hmm. The gaze is how this text already knows that you are watching. And then it shows you in certain moments. That a really great example is in Psycho, when we don't yet know, spoiler alert, normies, Norman Bates is the killer. Okay. Yeah. So at this point in the film, when he's trying to sink the car, okay, in the marsh, right?
Right.
To try to cover up ostensibly for, you know, for his mother, right? So it's going down, it's sinking and sinking, it stops.
Right.
He starts to panic. Okay. You, the viewer, do too.
Yeah. Because these turn to him. Yeah.
Which you would never admit consciously, because you want the murderer to be found out. You want justice for Janet Leigh. But in that moment, the movie knew that some dark part of you wants this to work, wants it to be covered up, right? I forget the name of the painting, but there's one part of it where there is a memento mori. It's a skull that, you know, when you stand there, it's waiting for you, right? And there was I read an analysis of it once, and the person is a professor. They said one of my students asked, well, now that I know that it's there, you know, the gaze is an operative, because I never stand in that location. And he said, no, the gaze knows that you're trying not to look. The painting knows you're trying not to look, because you'll see it and you'll know. I read that look to us in the same way. Like, and look, here's my subjective bias. I'm more inclined towards, like, this isn't going to get better. Yes, I see that as an invitation to, will you be deluded with me? would you be okay with this?
Yeah. I actually don't disagree with you. I think that's part of it, because I think the real tension in this film is it better to live in reality and stay condemned, or is it better to be received into a possible delusion? And that's a very real tension. We have, you know, we have people who live completely on the outskirts, on the outside of any version of belonging in their community. And if and that is why they are so vulnerable to praying, P-R-E-Y, praying sensibilities who come in and be like, I'll receive you. You know, you're welcome here. And it's like, that's why they can be drawn in. I think that's a real tension at the heart of this film. I couldn't agree more with you about, like, her look at us like, oh, yeah, like an invitation. Yeah.
You articulating it that way makes me able to say that we are more in agreement on this.
Yeah. Thing. Yeah. You know, absolutely. Yeah.
The contradiction that I was talking about is there, but it is meant to be. Then you are supposed to dwell within.
Yeah.
Am I okay with this?
Right.
That's one thing. Instead of the failure of, like, if it was straightforwardly, isn't this wonderful? Yay.
Right. Because that the final
failure.
Yeah, exactly. Because there is a big difference between contradiction and tension. And I definitely think this film has an emotional tension and a philosophical tension. I don't feel that it has a philosophical contradiction. I do think she is invited into, she's a pet. That's all she is. Yeah. She's a pet.
Yeah.
And at the end of this film, she is no different than a stray dog that you have, you know, found and domesticated and brought into your home. She's no different. She doesn't own the house. We're not talking about autonomy here. Yes, she doesn't have one of those little bubbly things like in her throat controlling her.
But
we're not talking about autonomy. We're talking about, again, like, well, it's the best
and
analogy.
Any second she could be turned on.
But,
you know,
well, but
which,
okay,
is also
but look,
true. Yeah.
But look, she doesn't need the parasite, because she is controlled by her desire.
Also true. Ish. Yes.
Okay.
Yeah,
that's
also
that's
true.
Like,
yes.
The all powerful aliens must recognize we don't need this thing.
Yeah.
We know the way to control her.
Yeah.
We will give her what she says that she wants.
And I think some of my energy earlier, hopefully not, but I think some of my energy earlier may have potentially misrepresented as in, like, oh yeah, Bryn's good. And Bryn, you know, like, this is a good thing that she's, I don't, maybe I did posit that. I'm simply saying to her, for her experience, she is in a place that she is better off in her experience of everything because she has received. And I do think there are very real things you could level at this film that would say, like, no, man, she's deluded. She's lost in the delusion. This is a horror film. It's a horror film. Mm-hmm. Like, mm-hmm. you know, so naturally at the end of it, if she's in a place, like, think about the ending of The Witch. Like, think about
what I thought of. Yes.
Yeah. At the end of The Witch, it's like you could have a very real conversation about whether that's a happy ending or not. Well, for her, it is. She's not in oppression. She's living deliciously. That's what she's been invited to. But look at what that really looks like, you know, and that's the emotional tension. I find that very, very interesting. And I don't think the film is confused. I do think that tension is intentional. I think that you're supposed to be a bit torn by whether or not this is, you know, a good thing for her or something that is aspirational, you know, like,
well, and you know, when the word confused into the conversation, like I said, it's either me or it, and clearly it is me. But I do enjoy sort of, and I say sincerely, I do enjoy the unlock of just, you know, kind of dissecting that final beat a bit more and what it means retroactively throughout the film. I know for Reed's sake, for a minute there, he was thinking, no one will save me right now. Like, just no one.
Oh, I felt
no one will save me.
I felt pretty good, but I hear
you. Yeah. Well, I meant from the dummies. Yeah.
But no, I mean, like, I will say one last thing, and Kate,
look at your screen. Look at your screen. Yes, plural.
I'm here for my brother. Okay.
yes. Your brother.
I will say, so listen, I will say this. The salvific language is pretty specific to religious constructs. But that was in case we are winding down the conversation to move to more shallow things and drifting up towards the surface and towards home to end the episode, I do want to say, like, that's something that resonated a lot with me in wondering about, again, it's a tension, so to speak, but just that feeling. I have sat in places, whether or not it was objectively true, I have sat in places where I felt, if anybody hears this about me, I am cut off. If anybody, again, whether or not that is objectively true of what haunts me,
sure,
I have sat in those places and felt like if they hear this and they reject me and everybody rejects me, what then will that look like? And I think the first time through, I was thinking, ooh, cool alien movie. Oh, there's no dialogue and they make weird geometric shapes and blah, blah, blah. But this time around, I think I just, in the first 5 minutes of the movie, I think I just tapped into that, where I was like, oh my God, she's irredeemable in her mind, whether or not it's really true, she's irredeemable. And nobody in her surrounding area has any desire to tell her otherwise. And I think about God. And I think about faith, and I think about the many, many times, the many ways we, either on this show or in our life or in big, grand notions, would say, like, well, no, like, no, there's a path. Sure, there are consequences, but there's a path. There's a path to reception. There's a path to acceptance. There's a path to redemption and forgiveness. Like, we would say those kind of things. It's that it's not true that no one will save you. It's not that that's not true. In Bryan Stevenson's words, that you are more than the worst thing you have ever done. You know, that there are, you know, that is a lie, that it is a lie that no one will save you. Now, what this film makes very interesting is, what if the one who sees you and the one who understands you and the one who welcomes you is a conqueror, is a, you know, a Viking, is, you mm-hmm. know, the Americans when they first, you know, or the Christopher Columbuses come in, and like, what if the person who receives and welcomes you is a conquering genocidal maniac? You know, like, mm-hmm. that's a real conversation to unpack about what this film has and the very real bliss that Bryn experiences at the end. That could be read as nightmarish. That could be read as horror. That also could be read as, well, the geopolitical ramifications of what has just happened are devastating. But good for Bryn. You know, yeah, like it. You know, it's that's why I found this film more interesting and energizing my second time through, is because the first time through I was just like, oh, they don't talk and the aliens look cool and what at the ending, and and this time through I just clicked on that.
More of an earnestry the first time.
So yeah, but that's also, you know, the benefit of watching something the second time through, knowing where it's going, because mm-hmm. it can help kind of connect some dots about what the film might more broadly be interested in that I didn't catch the first time through. But yeah, that's anyway, I've talked a lot. So I would welcome if there's other, we can certainly move to more shallow concluding sort of things, or if anybody has anything else to throw on there. I don't want to, you know, like the aliens, shove a little spiny warthog in your mouth and just let, yeah, control you.
I'm happy moving on. I will say, I won't even frame this as, I wish this movie had done this. How about I just say, I would love if a movie took the risk of having an attempted alien abduction for its entire runtime
mm-hmm.
and did only that. And I don't think that I would ever shut up about that movie for being about one thing and trying to do it as well as it could.
Yeah. Invasion of the Body Snatchers, 1978. It's a great film, and that's all it's about.
Cheeky little Barlow, you.
I do love the Body Snatcher films, but that was me being cheeky.
I do too, but yeah. Don't do it again.
I haven't seen it since the theater. Is Spielberg's War of the Worlds not in that spirit? Or does it get a little trauma?
Yeah.
Oh, okay,
yeah.
What I mean is the way that this movie was PR'd to me as one night where aliens come and you got to fend for yourself. I think that Spielberg's War of the Worlds is largely pretty good. But it's not this. It's not a very intimate and raw grim
I get that.
Exorcism of my terrors between 1993 and 1996.
Well, as we move on, that wasn't meant to be as dismissive
as it came out. Yeah, just dismiss more.
He really read like Ian makes his thing. He's like, well, moving on. And well, that was so fun.
Let's go to things that aren't stupid.
While we move on to the next segment, wasn't that dumb?
No, we just left that one. We just left that segment. No, I was actually going to express to Reed, because I know, you know, you probably felt a little, I don't know how exactly you would term how you felt, but like, abducted. I see better, Dwayne Berry, I see better kind of what the picture you were painting, you know, so I don't want you to feel like, you know, it's lackey against the world.
well, you
know, guys, we've talked about a lot, but if it's gory, if it's gross,
well,
if it causes you a fright, what scares you about this movie? What makes you say, that ain't right?
Sure as hell ain't right. Podcast listeners will not be able to appreciate your alien geometric.
Yeah. Yep. This is great alien radio.
Yeah. It's great radio. Oh, he did the Megan dance on that episode, and I was like, this is gonna be fun for our listeners.
I wish that your pit sweat somehow could translate over the airwaves, because that was part of the horror.
Dude, oh my god.
You know what?
What?
Unplug him, somebody.
Nathan's like, I was dismissing you.
Yeah. Oh, that was real.
It was stupid.
What you felt, that was dumb. So what you said, all of it, dumb.
Dude, that was brutal. High school bully stupid. Nathan unlocked.
There's like a money. Sauna in this house. but thanks for that vulnerability moment with Ian. All right, so that ain't right, Tom. Typically, I would come to our guests first, but I'm going to come to Reed first. You know,
still punishing me.
Shows you right. No one will save you, Ian.
Right.
No one will save you.
That's the game. It's like the game.
Loud and clear. You know?
Let's see how low we can make anyone on the call feel. I'm just kidding. God. Let's not do that. That's a terrible way to be. Reed, sincerely, what would you pick as your that ain't right here?
Well, the horror present in the film is fairly palatable. I think most of it's fairly palatable. But I will tell you the moment that really gives me the heebie-jeebies, the moment that I will say like, okay, yeah, that was that was good, is, and it's the extended sequence, but it's the one where she's hiding under the desk and the mannequin with the dress on it falls over. So she, you know, she turns that way. She's braced. She's got her scissors. She turns that way. So it's not just that when she turns back, the alien is just chilling there, just like, oh, hi there. Well, thought you escaped me, didn't you? Like, no dialogue, but boy, you see everything in that swagger where
body
it's like,
language.
Yeah. Like, oh, hi there. Oh, now you see me. Okay. What would you like to do? And then as she like kind of begins to move away, you know, it toys with her. It rips the frame out of her hand. It rips the scissors out of her hand. And it does so with this very confident swagger, just like a, you know, holds up its hand and just sort of flicks its long fingers. And just that whole sequence, I was like, that is chilling. Like just the whole thing. Cause the exhibition of the power of these creatures. Yes, she manages through some carelessness on some of their parts to get the upper hand in a couple of situations, but it's full demonstration of like, this is what I can do. Like, what you got? I thought that whole sequence was great. Just really fun. Yes.
Okay, Ian, your turn.
I get the talking stick.
Well, you get the talking stick right in the shoulder, and then you get a cabinet to the face.
fridge door.
I have the exact same sequence in mind, and it's because I feel like that's the closest that it comes to approximating the primal terror that I felt when I would consider alien abduction. Because it's an exhibition of power, but also there is that sadistic playing with her. And I think that, so all today I've been thinking about, you know, recording this episode tonight, and I was trying to think, like, what was it that was so particularly heart-stoppingly terrifying about the idea of being abducted by aliens? And I think that it is, again, you know, nods to Duane Barry, the powerlessness that and we didn't quite see that in this movie, because Brynn, you know, she accomplishes it. She fends off the invaders.
She's savvy. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But that's the closest that we get to some kind of idea of, we can turn off your ability to defend yourself. We can outwit whatever you come up with. Mm-hmm. Like, this is inevitable, and no one will save you. Mm-hmm. That's the closest that it came to approximating that kind of feeling of, it doesn't matter what I think of or how, you know, any ingenuities that I might have or my knowledge of the floor plan, they are what they are is one step ahead permanently. So that's what I would say.
Yeah. Awesome.
I love it. I think for me, it hasn't even been pointed to during this conversation, but I think what I would and had probably the strongest, other than the I keep referring to it as the yoga alien aspect of the aliens being so bonkers a visual thing, and not being sort of ready for that the first time through, I think the other thing that was so striking and ultimately repulsive to me in the first viewing that mostly carried over into the second viewing is when she finally gets taken in the red, the tractor beam, right? And, you know, I think Ian, you may have just referenced here, or both of you did, referring to that other scene, the toying nature of what's happening here when she finally gets caught, and just this like you know, yo-yo levitational sort of pull that they're executing against her. And then y'all, like, probably tapping into some deeper subconscious, like, you know, whatever's for me. The visual, yes, but the thought too of this creature disgorging from its throat this tiny, spindly, foreign, sentient object hovering in space, and it itself, wow. I mean, like, it's so vile, mm-hmm. and just repulsive, and both visually and psychologically,
yeah.
And to the point that you'll recall, when is it, I think it's literally the next shot, when she's out of the red, well, no, she wakes up, okay, she wakes up in the dream, and then,
yeah,
or the dreamscape, but her removal from that is, mm-hmm. is placing her hand down her throat to pull this thing. I mean, it's just,
yeah,
that whole aspect of it, just absolutely, that ain't right whatsoever.
We have such sights to show you.
Well, and it's worth noting, you talk about, like, the, well, man, we're in That Ain't Right, and here I am, no, risking bringing us back to the, like, you talk about that moment where she rips the thing out. I think, right, to your point, Ian, about, like, will you be deluded? She would not let herself surrender to that illusion that they gave her where Maud is still alive. She wouldn't, she wouldn't let herself surrender to that falsehood. And I think that was because she did not want to live in a world where what she had done hadn't happened. She wanted to live in a world where what she had done had happened and it didn't matter. Where maybe not that it didn't matter, but that it was, sure, forgiven. That it was received in spite of it, rather than an illusion where, oh yeah, Maud never died. I'm sorry, Maud, I'm gonna reject that and then accept the world where, like, oh no, they saw what I did, not trying to change it, just accepts it. Anyway, just throwing log on the fire, you know. But
I totally agree with that. Like, she needs her symbolic castration, in part is Maud's death. She needs and wants that pain.
Yes. Yes.
The more noble aspect of that is perhaps, like, the reality principle, but there's also the death drive in all of us. It's like, I need this form of my lack. I need this. I need this thorn in my side. So I totally agree.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, did you squirm? Did you wince? Did you squint your eyes real tight?
I have no sound.
It was probably because of what we around here call.
That sure as hell ain't right.
Oh my gosh. I hope you guys felt the way that I did, in the sense that, like, I really loved the conversation. Like, I I get thrilled by that kind of thing, because it, you know, it's just, it's invigorating to me to really dive into these films in a way that isn't just dancing along the surface, but really makes you think about certain things. So I've loved that. And that means that we've come to the point where we rate all of these films on our specific metric for The Fear of God. And that is the fog meter, where we rate not the quality of the films per se, but their gravity, the demands they make upon you, the viewer. And we do that in two metrics, one of fear, which is the scares, the substance, how disturbing, gnarly, gross, upsetting the thing is, and what we call God meter, which is the substance of the thing. What does the film have on its mind, and how effectively does it convey that? Actually, Ian, I'm going to begin with you. You may give me both your fear and your God number. Give me two numbers. On a scale of 0 to 10, what would you give Brian Duffield's No One Will Save You?
I'll start with fear, and I'm going to give it a 6.5.
All right.
And that's because I wanted to have a good showing, but I also want to, you know, reflect and be as consistent as I can, that, like, I don't tend to be frightened by horror movies. That doesn't make me love them any less. I'm always on the lookout for that, but this did excite a few old twinges of fear. and it was delicious.
Awesome. And what would you say for the God meter?
I'm going to give that a 7.
Okay.
Because again, I want this to have a strong showing. I thought this was pretty good. My criticisms stand, but I don't think that they are like so robust or so so material that it really detracts from it that much. So
yeah, understood. I'll go next, Nathan. I'll let you round us off. For Fear, I mean, we didn't spend a lot of time on it, but for the sake of noting, like, the suspense sequence with the aliens is solid. Like this, mm-hmm. Especially for a first time viewing, the scenes where the alien is creeping in, construction wise, visually, those suspense sequences are really, really strong. I do think they would have diminishing returns. As much as I loved the film, they had diminishing returns on me the second time through. So I think a first time viewing, they're really high. As you know what's coming, then they may downturn a bit, but I still think they're pretty harrowing on that first time viewing. So for Fear, I'm going to give it a 7. If I was rating this my first viewing, I probably would have gone pretty low on the God meter. Probably would have gone 5. This time around, as the conversation exhibited, I got super tapped into what I think the film was about, or what I think it was interested in. Still don't think it landed all of its strikes and jabs effectively, but I think it hit a lot closer than I gave it credit for my first time through. And it invigorated me to a degree that I'll revisit this film with more intention, with an eye towards that, and with more thoughtfulness around that. And so I'm going to land on an 8 for the God meter for this time around, based on my second viewing. And it is something that I think continues to fascinate me. You know, the what the film has on its mind about, you know, this condemnation versus forgiveness, redemption, being received by someone else, and the, you know, the dangers therein, the joys therein, you know, all kinds of things that we didn't even fully get into about religious aspects of that. And ways we view God and his response to us and those kinds of things. So yeah, I think it's very, really fascinating. So land on an 8 there for me. Nathan, what would you say for your Fear and your God meter?
I think after the first viewing, I probably would have gone something like maybe even as high as an 8 on Fear. I think to what's already been said in multiple and various ways, the diminishing returns aspect is real. And so I think for Fear, I'm going to settle at a 6. I think the imagery all still works. I think the design of pretty much every choice works largely, but just your experience of it is pretty different the second go around. For the God quotient, I think for me, this conversation did a lot to close the gap on, you know, what I was unsure how to feel, interpret, or understand. So I will go with a 6 on the God meter, which is okay. Basically a pointing towards that rank could grow over time, just kind of where I'm at right now and my appreciation of those things. Yeah,
sure, that's fair. And that means that we give No One Will Save You a 6.75, which will round right up to a 7 on 7 out of 10 on the Fog meter. Pretty strong showing, to your point, Ian. But perhaps never more appropriate question to ask than now, after the conversation we've had, where are we at with this film? So, Ian, after the conversation we've had, where are you at with No One Will Save You?
I mean, I would tell people to watch it. I would invite people to watch it, like, with me. and then I can just unload, you know, years worth of...
trauma, just yeah. Say it.
Trauma. There it is. Yeah. Trauma.
Elevated trauma. Ian.
Ari Aster will blush when he hears what I have to say.
Yeah. Oh gosh. Yeah, that's awesome.
A24, sign me up.
Nathan, after this conversation, where are you at with it?
I think this conversation has done a lot for me, for what I was feeling coming out of the second viewing. You know, I really when you remove the suspense part, which happens after a first viewing, and are still left a little befuddled by what exactly it's after, it can feel a little deflating for what was initially a pretty strong experience. And so I feel like our conversation has yielded a lot of dividends on, you know, how to receive the movie. So yeah, I feel pretty good about it, and I was never at a place of dislike. it was more at a place of uncertainty. And so I feel like I'm back a little back closer to where I was after viewing one.
That's fair. Well, I'm glad to hear that. For me, I think the second viewing obviously elevated my appreciation for the film, even more so as we've discussed it. And I've been able to articulate some of the thoughts that were percolating around in my spirit, even with some of the challenges. Really excellent points that both of you made helped to sort of temper in some ways and solidify in other ways, you know, my appreciation for this film. I think it's smarter than I gave it credit for my first time through. And I am very, very interested and emotionally compelled by what it has on its mind about irredeemable people who might suddenly be faced by an offer of redemption from their aliens. So I can say it, from monsters. And what does that look like when your offer of redemption has come from a monster? And that is endlessly fascinating to me. I'm very, very keen on this film. And I think, look, we've talked all highfalutin about this. First time through, it's a fun watch. It's super fun. So even though our conversation yielded towards the more heavy thematic stuff as we tend to do, it is very, very fun. If you have not seen this film, we've spoiled a lot about it, but it's what we haven't spoiled actually is a lot of the interior scenes of the aliens and the suspense sequence. And that's a lot of where the fun sits, and in a really strong way. So
fun, yeah.
fun, air quotes. It's very fun.
The years of sleepless nights fun. Yeah,
yep, chewed my knuckles to the bone, but yes, it's so much fun. So
13 out of 10. Yes.
That's awesome. Well, Ian, thank you so much for being a part of this. It's always a pleasure to see you. Nathan, thank you as always. Listeners, thank you as always. Being very candid and open with you, as of this recording, we're recording this a little early from its release, so we don't yet know what our schedule holds for next week. This is essentially the epilogue of our look back series at some of the strongest and most interesting films of 2023. I'm sure we will revisit one or two of 2023 films along the way, but this officially concludes the series. So we'll be going somewhere different next, and we just don't know what that is yet. So stay tuned to social media, check out the Facebook group, look for posts in the Patreon feed or on any of the various platforms where you can find us, and we'll tell you where we're going next. But as we say on every episode, the fear of God is the beginning of wisdom, but not the end of the conversation. And in that spirit, we encourage you to fear nothing else and be on your way rejoicing. Gentlemen, thank you so much again. I love this conversation. Listeners, thank you as well. And we will see you all next week.
The fear of God is the beginning of wisdom, but not the end of the conversation. And you can continue the conversation in a variety of ways. Start by visiting thefearofgodpodcast.com for links to our social media and episode archive, essays, merchandise, and more. If you love what we do, consider becoming a patron by visiting patreon.com/thefearofgodpodcast, where you will unlock exclusive bonus episodes, extended standard episodes, online events, and so much more. Special thanks to Jacob Hunt of TracerMatula.com for our artwork. Our assortment of talented musicians, Andrew Nelson, The Island Family, and Jackson Harper for our varied show tunes. And to Lee Wright and Reed Lackey for our theme music. Special thank you also to Tyler Smith at MoreThanOneLesson.com. Lastly, be sure to subscribe to us on your podcast platform of choice. And if you listen to us through Apple Podcasts, we would greatly appreciate a rating and a review. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you next week.
Hi, everybody.